It's Sunday morning, and that wonderfully relaxed feeling of a long, lazy day lingers in the air. If you want to make the moment last, may I suggest the perfect solution? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday refresh, a chance to take a deep breath, relax, and know that the stress of Monday may be just around the corner, but not here, not now. So make this your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And know this, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen, and thank you.
Hey, everybody, dealing with a cold and it's wrecking my voice. Anyways, we're here to talk about nutrition with Dr. Rebecca Fujimura and also answer your health insurance and healthcare questions. So let's start with welcoming Dr. Fujimura, who serves as Global Health Fellowship Director and Assistant Professor at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine. Works with the Cincinnati Department of Health and is a co-director of Doctors for America's Capello Fellowship. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. And I'm sorry you're not feeling well.
And this is what happens. Sometimes we get sick and we work through it.
Yeah, so absolutely.
Let's talk about those new nutrition guidelines. What's in them?
Yeah, so there are a lot of different changes that have happened since the previous guidelines, but I like to break it down by each bullet point. So the first bullet point that they point out is that you should eat the right amount for you. This obviously is a good recommendation in a holistic sense, but it's very vague for each individual person. There are many people in this country that have multiple medical diagnoses based on their weight, their lifestyle, that they might have different nutritional needs. And I do want to preface that these are meant to be just general guidelines for the whole entire population, but all the recommendations don't necessarily fit each individual's needs. So as a family medicine physician, I think this is a conversation that we should be having more with our patients and that I think people should feel empowered to have with their healthcare provider or their nutritionist, because based on your healthcare needs, you might need differing aspects to your nutritional intake than what are in these recommendations. So although this bullet point is kind of a holistic approach, it's very vague, and I think that it could have been more highlighted and looped in with the original intent, which was to address the chronic illnesses that are happening in this country right now, as well as to help with obesity rates. I think with this, too, them talking about portion sizes. Previously, you know, they used to use the plate that would show the amount of fruits, grains, vegetables, proteins generally that should be on your plate. And gave a little bit of an idea of what your plate should look like, but not necessarily portion sizes. And with, again, saying that you should eat the right amount for you, again, that's very vague. And I think talking to a healthcare provider, you might be able to sit down and say, okay, here is actually this many ounces or this many pieces of what I should be eating when it comes to fruits, vegetables, proteins. And, you know, small things, if people are trying to limit their portion sizes, as a physician, one technique I tell people is put your fork down in between taking a bite. That's going to help with the hormones that tell you that you're full and have satiety, that you're truly full at that moment. And it gives your brain the time to process, as opposed to if you're not putting your fork down, you might be eating so quickly that those hormones don't have time to fully tell your brain, oh, yes, in fact, I am full. I don't need to continue to eat. So the next bullet point that these new guidelines highlight is to prioritize proteins at every meal. And I do think proteins, they're a very important aspect of our diet. Every single person needs to take in some sort of protein. But it's also important to remember a lot of aspects of our nutrition are made up of many different parts. So macronutrients, micronutrients, vitamins. And I liked the previous depiction when we used the plate, because it's not just about prioritizing necessarily one food over another for every single meal, but it's about getting the balance that you need. So the word prioritize, that might mean more to someone versus, okay, well, I can fill my entire plate full of protein versus, oh, I should have vegetables on my plate as well as some whole grains. And, you know, we'll get into this further, but one of my critiques of this pyramid is that there's depiction of steak at the very top of the pyramid when it comes to said proteins. You know, eating beef, there are positives to eating things like steak, but there are a lot of people that steak is not the best option as their protein source, given if they have heart disease, they have high cholesterol. There's also a lot of fat content in red meat. So the depiction of that within the pyramid gives me a little pause, because that's not the go-to protein that I personally would choose for most of my patients, especially the ones that are, you know, battling a chronic disease. And within the recommendations, this administration saying that they are combating chronic diseases, that seems kind of counterintuitive to put that towards the top of the pyramid. Kind of continuing on with that, saying to consume dairy as the next bullet point. I agree, everyone should consume some dairy. But this recommendation of going into whole milk is over 1% or 2% milk. I don't agree with that recommendation. Whole milk has a lot of fat content in it. And for some populations, right, like ages under 2, we say, yes, we want them to have the full fat content. But as you transition into other ages, we don't need to be taking in that much fat, especially drinking it. And this administration focusing on things such as whole foods, that definition is not necessarily clear. And I think they've extrapolated it to saying, well, whole milk is a whole food. But when you look at 1 or 2% milk, you're just mostly taking out some of that extra fat that you don't necessarily need. And so if we're focused on combating obesity rates, we're focused on, you know, combating chronic disease again, this again is very conflicting, saying that we should be pushing whole milk. And now even, you know, RFK is going around saying potentially raw milk or these other aspects, but those are not healthy choices when you're looking at some of the goals that we're trying to move towards when it comes to this, the healthier population. And like I said, combating chronic disease. The next bullet point, you know, eat vegetables and fruits throughout the day. Absolutely. We want to be eating whole vegetables, whole fruits. One criticism I would say with the nutritional guidelines is saying that canned foods are okay. Especially canned vegetables, they tend to have a lot of excess sodium in them. And the equivalence of nutrition that you're getting from a fresh fruit or vegetable or frozen fruit and vegetable versus canned is very different. So I think equating those two is not a fair assessment and should not have been included in the guidelines. I would always recommend to my patients, if you have, for example, if you're in a food desert and you can't get to fresh fruits and vegetables, if you have the ability to do frozen, a lot of those, the fruits and vegetables are flash frozen, and it keeps the nutrients inside and they last for a lot longer. Always choose the frozen over the canned if you have the ability to do so. And the other aspect, saying that juices are okay. Juices, we know, are mostly just sugar. Again, it's very conflicting with the entire goal of the nutritional guidelines, saying at the beginning of promoting health, of combating chronic diseases, combating obesity. There's not much nutritional, there is some nutritional value, of course, in juice, but it's mostly sugar. And if you're eating the whole piece of fruit, you're getting other nutrients and especially the fiber, which is the most important part. So saying that juice is also acceptable, I would say that needs that recommendation. I would not stand behind because the whole fruit or whole vegetable is going to be better. And I also tell my patients all the time, right? Look at the, if you do get juice, look at the label. A lot of times it will say juice cocktail instead of juice. And that is just sugar and flavorings to make it taste like juice, but it's actually, there's very little fruit juice actually in it. The next bullet point, incorporate healthy fats. Again, a little vague. What does healthy fats mean? And we've always focused on cooking with things like olive oil, which we know is heart healthy, is a good oil to be cooking with. And now they're saying that aspects like butter and beef tallow are just as good and that you should be cooking with those. I'm going to loop back to what I said previously regarding the steak. Beef tallow is very high in cholesterol. If you have had a previous heart attack or you have high blood pressure, diabetes, cooking with beef tallow is not the best option for you. And I think for the general population, this should not have been a recommendation. Butter is the same way. And if you're also recommending that people limit their salt, it said nothing about unsalted versus salted butter. So a lot of people might, their go-to is to buy salted butter. So if they're cooking all of their meals in salted butter, your sodium levels are now rising. Again, someone who has high blood pressure, that can be incredibly dangerous and in combating what we're trying to do to make that person healthier. The other piece of this, the next bullet point was focus on whole grains. I do agree with that. I think that they need to expand those bullet points a little bit more to explain to people that are reading it, what is a whole grain? What does that mean? So I tell, you know, my patients, look for the brown breads, the brown pastas, and limit ones that are, you know, saying bleached or white bread, crackers, things like those. The next bullet point says that we're going to limit highly processed foods. This, of course, is a very, there's been a lot of discussion about this and, you know, a lot of different platforms because same thing. What is a processed food? You know, nutrition in general, right, is this big kind of monster that when people come into my office and say, I say, what is your diet like? And they say normal. Like, what does normal mean? I don't eat that many processed foods. Well, what does processed foods mean to you? And there's a lot of research being done in this area, but a lot of nutritionists, I have heard them say, think of a processed food as if you can't truly make it in your kitchen, it's probably processed or has multiple chemical additives, things like that to preserve it. You know, that's kind of a generalization. There's a lot of foods that you might not be able to make in your kitchen, but are still healthy or healthier, for example. So I think that this section, they really needed to focus on what they mean by processed foods and give people a more clear definition and their reasoning behind it. Because for example, if you go to the grocery store and you grab a bag of Cheetos and the other person next to you grabs a bag of lentil chips, they're both probably what we think of as processed, but the nutritional value within them is vastly, vastly different. There's still protein, good carbohydrates in a lentil chip versus a Cheeto has very little nutritional value in it. So I tell people, patients, that they really should, again, have these discussions with your healthcare provider who is going to maybe look at your food diary, look at what you're eating and can say, okay, yes, these are what some things that I would consider cutting out or what might be processed on the spectrum of what your healthcare goals are. Within this aspect, I also think them saying limiting sugary beverages. I do agree with that. We have a lot of added sugars in a lot of drinks, a lot of, you know, snacks in general. And so I tell people to look for things that say no added sugar or to just limit sugary drinks such as soda, pop. I do tell my patients there's really no nutritional value in soda and pop. And if there's one thing you could cut out, that is one I would recommend. And just getting to the last bullet point of the nutritional guidelines, which is limit alcoholic beverages. Again, I think this is very vague. Previously, we would say one drink for a woman, two drinks for a man, and now they're just generally saying limit. But for someone who their normal is to drink six drinks per day, say six beers per day, their definition of limit might be, well, I cut down to five or I cut down to four, but that wouldn't necessarily be the best thing for their health. So I think that these guidelines really needed to be more strict and more stringent and more clear when it comes to how to approach consuming alcohol. So again, a lot of these aspects of the nutritional guidelines, there were some good changes, like, you know, limiting foods that don't have extra nutritional value, like the sugary drinks, quote unquote, processed foods. You know, if we think of like Doritos, Cheetos, things like that, it is good that there's vegetables towards the top and an emphasis on whole foods, and whole foods in the sense of whole fruits, whole vegetables, whole grains, but not necessarily whole milk, focusing on the definition of the natural food, but not emphasis on it not being, you know, altered or cooked and provided in a different way. And I think, again, the bad aspects, you know, I wouldn't agree with these quote unquote healthy fats that we're highlighting now. I wouldn't agree with the red meat and the beef tallow being added up there. Again, for most of our population that has high blood pressure, hypertension, heart disease, a lot of different chronic diseases, this would not be my first choice to recommend. Whole milk, there's a lot of extra fat in there that's not needed. And this fight in general against carbohydrates. You know, I tell people we're human. We were meant to consume food. And I think we've learned to have this fight with carbohydrates as well as a fight with food in general. And I don't think that we should view food as an enemy. It's part of our natural being. I think we need to look at it as a partnership and taking in what's a good balance for yourself and what your body needs. And again, I would really encourage everyone to discuss with their healthcare provider, discuss with the nutritionist. I think a lot of these politicians or people that are quote unquote self-proclaimed nutritional experts, they have a lot of money in the game, right? They're selling you supplements that you don't need. They are in it for their own benefit versus your primary care provider who knows all aspects of your health is going to take that into account when giving you nutritional guidance.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Fujimura, for clearing that up and letting us know what in the food pyramid is good guidance and what people should talk to their doctor and nutritionist about. So thanks again for joining us. And now welcome to Louise Norris, the health insurance and healthcare reform analyst at healthinsurance.org, to answer your health insurance questions. So let's start with President Trump finally released concepts of a healthcare plan. So what has the president proposed and how will that affect our healthcare?
Yeah, so as far as what has actually been proposed, it is very light on details. So we have, you know, basically concepts of a plan. Some of it is stuff that already exists. Some of it is stuff that might be beneficial, but we really don't know without the solid details. And some of it is stuff that would just probably be bad or would definitely be bad. So one of the things is most favored nation drug pricing for the United States, basically getting the same prices that other wealthy countries pay for their drugs here in the United States. The problem is there's no details, there's no enforcement, we do not have legislative text for this plan. We literally just have some bullet points. So this would very much depend on how it gets done, whether there's any sort of whether this is just sort of asking drug companies to lower their prices or if there's any concrete steps that are being taken to actually make this happen. And it is important to note that last summer in Trump's Big Beautiful Bill that was enacted last July, one of the provisions of that bill actually took the Medicare drug pricing program that was already had already been implemented in the Inflation Reduction Act and delayed some of it so that certain drugs would have a longer time horizon before they'd be eligible for price negotiations. So that's the thing that's like concrete that we've actually already seen that does not help with drug pricing. So this is sort of a lot of talk and we don't know yet whether anything will actually come of it. Another part of this, so and it is really important to note that Trump's healthcare plan does not extend the marketplace premium subsidy enhancements that expired at the end of 2025. That's been an issue we've been talking about for months on this show. That is not part of it. In fact, he's talking about giving the money to directly to consumers so that they can buy whatever health insurance they want. Again, very light on details. We don't know whether this would just let people buy literally any product they want, which could include plans that are not regulated by the Affordable Care Act. We don't know how much people would get, because that's one important part of the way marketplace subsidies are structured and the way the subsidy enhancements were structured is they're very personalized. So each person gets exactly what they need to make their coverage affordable. So everybody gets a different amount in terms of the way the ACA subsidies work. If you're just giving people money, are they talking about giving people all the same amount of money? Are they talking about still calculating it on a personalized approach and giving people that money? What limits would there be on how you could use it? Again, without any details on that, it's really hard to say how that would work and whether it would benefit people. Another thing in this plan is to fund cost sharing reductions. And this has been widely reported in the media as lowering premiums by 10%. And it's really important that people know that is absolutely not the case. All it would do if, so cost sharing reductions are part of the Affordable Care Act. For lower income folks, they get lower out-of-pocket costs, lower deductibles, lower copays, stuff like that, when they use their health plan. Back in 2017, the first Trump administration stopped funding that program. In response, the insurance companies and the state regulators around the country started having the insurance companies add the cost of that program just directly to silver plan premiums. The roundabout result of that, because premium subsidies are based on the cost of silver plan premiums, everybody's premium subsidies went up. So what has been going on for the last several years is people who are eligible for these cost sharing reductions still get them. They don't, you know, they still get that benefit that was never interrupted, but everybody's premium subsidies are larger. So if they were to start funding cost sharing reductions again, all of a sudden then the price of silver plans would go down, which means everybody's premium subsidies would also go down. The only people who would benefit is a few hundred thousand people who buy silver plans and don't get premium subsidies. It's literally that there would be millions of people harmed and only a few hundred thousand people helped. So when you hear that talking point of funding cost sharing reductions, lowering premiums by 10%, that is completely false. And it's really important that people understand that. And then the other things in this bill are mostly, or in this plan, are mostly things that already exist under the ACA or actually regulations that the Trump administration put in place the first time around on like hospital transparency. That's a thing the Trump administration put in place back in 2020. There's requiring insurance companies to disclose like percentage of revenue they spend on premium or on medical care. That's already in there. It's part of the ACA. Requiring plain language explanations of benefits or, you know, what plans are, that's already in there, part of the ACA. So this is a mixed bag of stuff, some of which would definitely be harmful, and some of which already exists, and some of which we don't know whether it would be beneficial because we don't have any details yet.
Thanks, Louise. And it's kind of stunning that this took over a decade to come up with this, right? When it doesn't feel like it's really much of a plan.
Yes, it is. It definitely, 10 years. And we basically got one page, no legislative text. And it is just sort of a hodgepodge of ideas that, like I say, some of them literally the first Trump administration already put in place. So we'll see if anything comes of this as far as legislation. There is talk in Congress, it sounds like, of a bipartisan new sort of healthcare reform proposal, which importantly does not include ACA, marketplace, subsidy enhancement extension. We'll see whether any of these provisions get worked into that. But that's where we are right now.
And as you mentioned, the thing that's missing is the Affordable Care Act tax credit extension. Speaking of the Affordable Care Act, open enrollment is still going on in a few places. Tell us more.
Yes. So open enrollment in most of the country for marketplace plans and plans people buy, any individual market plan, whether you get it through the marketplace or directly from an insurance company, that ended January 15th in most of the country. But it is still going on in several states. So if you're in Massachusetts, you have until January 23rd. If you're in Virginia, you have until January 30th. And then if you are in California, Connecticut, Illinois, New Jersey, New York, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, or DC, you have until January 31st. So if you haven't picked a plan, or if your plan was auto-renewed and you'd like to pick a different one for the remainder of the year, you do still have time if you're in one of those states. If you are in the rest of the country, open enrollment is over. It's a good idea to keep yourself informed about how special enrollment periods work. If you have a qualifying life event that triggers a special enrollment period, knowing that and using it if you want to is a good idea. Also, stay tuned because it's possible Congress could do something with the subsidy enhancements and create a special enrollment period. Although I will say it's not looking particularly likely. The House did pass legislation to extend the subsidy enhancements for 3 years, but the Senate won't take up that bill. And the bipartisan compromise bill they're considering, as of right now, it still seems like they don't have enough Republicans on board to pass it. But consumers should still pay attention because if they were to do something there, they would likely open a special enrollment period for folks to take advantage of that. If you're uninsured right now and you're in a state where open enrollment has ended and you're considering alternatives to ACA compliant coverage, it's just really important to have a buyer beware approach there. Make sure you're reading the fine print. Just understand these plans are really lightly regulated. In some cases, like Farm Bureau plans and healthcare sharing ministries, they are literally not considered health insurance. So you do not have like the protection of the good insurance department in your state or anything like that. So you really need to, if you're buying coverage right now, outside of open enrollment, pay close attention to what you're getting.
Thanks. And let's talk about Medicare Advantage open enrollment, which is also going on right now. What does that mean?
Yeah, so Medicare Advantage open enrollment, it runs for the first 3 months of the year. So it continues through March 31st. And if you are already enrolled in a Medicare Advantage plan, this gives you an opportunity, you get one chance to make a change. So this is different from the fall window where you can make as many changes as you want. If you want to either switch to a different Medicare Advantage plan or switch to Original Medicare, you can do that now. If you do it, then you're new coverage would take effect the start of the following month after you make your plan selection. If you are on Medicare Advantage and you want to switch to Original Medicare, it's really important that you find out first whether you would be able to qualify for a Medicare supplement plan. In most states, the insurance company will be able to look at your medical history to decide whether you are eligible and if so, how much it's going to cost. So you don't want to find that out after you've switched because you only get one chance to switch. If you switch to Original Medicare and then try to apply for a Medicare supplement plan and find out you're rejected, you just have to wait until 2027 to change back. So if you're uncertain whether your medical history will make you eligible for a Medigap plan, you can contact a broker, you can contact the Medicare State Health Insurance Assistance Program in your state. You can call the Medigap companies directly and discuss it with them. But that's how that works. If you want to take advantage of it, you have until March 31st to make a change if you're on Medicare Advantage.
Thank you so much for the advice, Louise. And thank you, everybody, for joining us today to learn more about the new food guidelines and how they affect you. Please text or call in your health insurance questions, and we'll answer them in future episodes. This is Care Talk, and thanks for joining us. Care Talk with Laura Packard is a podcast covering healthcare in America from a progressive perspective. Our healthcare system is broken, and we all know insurance companies are out of control. If you don't have health insurance, or don't understand the differences between insurance plans, or have surprise medical bills, out-of-control prescription drug costs, or can't get the care you need, listen to Care Talk with Laura Packard weekly on Tuesdays. What's going to happen to your healthcare under the Trump administration? From prescription drug prices to health insurance costs, from healthcare for seniors and people with disabilities to reproductive care, from care for veterans to public health, including vaccinations. Healthcare experts answer your questions every week, and they go in-depth on Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act, private insurance, and more. Go to healthcarevoices.org/caretalk or search for Care Talk with Laura Packard on your favorite podcast app to listen today.